From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and what a day we have going on today. Attorney General Loretta Lynch being grilled right now by Congress on the FBI investigation into Hillary Clinton's use of emails. Meanwhile, in New Hampshire at this moment, Hillary Clinton is speaking after being endorsed by her rival for the Democratic nomination, Bernie Sanders, and we're waiting for President Obama to arrive in Dallas.
He'll speak at an interfaith memorial service set to start in a little more than an hour for five law enforcement officers murdered there last week. It'll be the 11th time that he'll speak to a city after a mass shooting since he became president, and the second time in the last month after speaking in Orlando a month ago. NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving is here. Hi, Ron.
Hello, Robin.
Start with the president flying into Dallas Love Field Airport. Many people who came to remember the police after the shooting at the site then went over to Dealey Plaza to memorialize the shooting of President Kennedy years ago. Are you feeling these historical overtones?
Indeed. Dallas, of course, will always connote the tragedy that is the central tragedy, perhaps, of the entire post-war period in the United States. It was attributed, many things were attributed to it. Many of the sorrows of the middle to late 60s were attributed to it, fairly or unfairly. It seemed to end a period of hope rising in America and bring on a period of Vietnam, riots in the cities, eventually Watergate, eventually economic problems. So it's a watershed moment for many people, and it's endlessly associated, sadly and tragically, with the city of Dallas.
Yeah, well, and some people are calling this a watershed moment for race relations, for police, community relations. Let's take that up for a second. And listen, with the president speaking in Arizona at a memorial for six people killed in Tucson in 2011.
I have come here tonight as an American who, like all Americans, kneels to pray with you today, and we'll stand by you tomorrow.
But Ron Elving, does the president maybe have a more particular needle to thread today? His Justice Department has been critical of some policing. He's spoken out about some systematic problems and in support of peaceful protests. Now, no one obviously is saying anything supporting the Dallas shooting. Horrendous. But some police are blaming his rhetoric for it.
Surely there's no more difficult needle to thread in American life than that racial tension that has been so rife in recent weeks and months, particularly around the issue of police shootings, people being killed, and particularly young black men. And this shooter in Dallas, evidence points to his having been motivated by revenge for some of those most recent shootings in Baton Rouge and in Minnesota. There is so much talk, so much rhetoric, and nothing can make it more difficult for this president than to address another incident of gun violence that is fraught with this kind of racial tension.
Yeah, well, we'll wait to hear how the event goes. But meanwhile, while we have you, other political news, Loretta Lynch testifying this morning before the House Judiciary Committee on Capitol Hill. Any big news there? Anything we haven't heard before about Hillary Clinton's use of emails?
Mostly a ratcheting up of the rhetoric by the committee chairman, Bob Goodlatte, and some of the other members, suggesting that she somehow had failed in her constitutional duty, although she has emphasized several times this morning that she merely accepted the unanimous recommendation of both the FBI investigators and the career prosecutors in her department. Nonetheless, she is the highest-ranking person in the Department of Justice, and they have already had the FBI director there to be raked over the coals last week, Jim Comey. So they're going after her again today. But here again, the issue of police violence, particularly as it affects the African-American community, has also become a large part of the discussion, as many of the Democratic members have been bringing that to the fore in this particular hearing.
Yeah, we just got about a minute. But as Jeremy said, Bernie Sanders endorsing Hillary Clinton in New Hampshire to a wave of cheers from her backers there. But, you know, how do you think his people are feeling in this moment? Are we taking enough time to mourn that campaign?
Some of them are. Some of them certainly are present and feeling mixed emotions. It must have been odd for Bernie Sanders, who gave most, if not all, of his usual stump speech with all of the usual language. But, of course, without the usual punchline of saying, and so I have to have your vote to be the next president. He had to slip over to saying, and so Hillary Clinton needs to be your next president because she has won the Democratic nomination. And he actually even went through the delegate math down to the last delegate to make it clear that he was recognizing the scoreboard as much as anything else. But there was some real enthusiasm, some almost affection between the two, and certainly some of the Bernie Sanders supporters are going to find that maybe small consolation, but most of the cheers today at this rally were for the actual nominee, Hillary Clinton.
To paraphrase from a past campaign, maybe affectionate enough. That's NPR Senior Washington Editor and Correspondent Ron Elving. Thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, there have been a number of territorial disputes in the South China Sea, with China claiming islands that are also claimed by other countries. China has also been building islands in the area. Well, today, an international tribunal ruled against China in a dispute with the Philippines. The court at The Hague said Beijing has no legal basis for its claims on the waters and said China had violated the sovereign rights of the Philippines. Joining us from Beijing is the BBC's Robin Brandt. And Robin, tell us, first of all, more about this ruling.
Well, it was expected. China had done nothing but try to undermine this whole process, particularly over the last week when it has had a huge military exercise in and around some of the disputed South China Sea areas. And that itself continued today, the day that the ruling came out. From The Hague in the Netherlands, the ruling is 500 pages long. And it is best characterized as a complete rejection of China's historic claims of sovereignty over huge swathes of the South China Sea and some of the economic privileges and other sovereignty claims that come with it.
How are Chinese officials reacting to the ruling?
Well, we've seen both the Premier Li Keqiang and the President Xi Jinping in photo op meetings with European politicians in the last few hours, but we haven't heard statements from either man. We have heard from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs here and a detailed statement on the state-run news agency Xinhua. That effectively was a bit of a history lesson which restated China's claims of sovereignty over these vast areas of the South China Sea. China's foreign minister has repeated the claim that they saw the whole process as a farce. They had said before today that they would not abide by it, and they are not going to abide by it. They still believe that they have rightful claims of sovereignty, and they continue to assert those claims. The key question, though, is what actually will China and its military presence in the South China Sea now do on these islands, in these seas? That is where we will see its tangible reaction, and that is where we'll be able to judge the tone of its reaction to this ruling.
And I guess the other key question is, can this be enforced, and who's going to enforce it?
Yeah, it can't be enforced, is the short answer to that. This tribunal is a United Nations tribunal, not a court, but it has concluded with a ruling, and that ruling is legally binding. But we have had instances in the past like this. The United States, which hasn't ratified the relevant treaty here, did not abide by a ruling that went against it in the 1980s involving Nicaragua. But China is a signatory to the relevant laws. It should abide by this, but it has said it will not. And it is very difficult to see how this can be enforced, certainly militarily. But what you have is an emboldened Philippines. Perhaps other smaller neighboring nations around here will feel they want to pursue a similar path. And China has had its claims of sovereignty utterly rejected. And the huge construction, the airstrips, the dredging that it's been doing for the last few years at great expense is now all illegal, technically.
Now, this was a dispute with the Philippines, but China has had disputes over its islands with Japan, with Vietnam. What does this say to you about the regional politics that in this case, it was the Philippines that went up against China and won?
Yeah, what it says is that this goes back a long way. And look, it goes back 2,000 years to when China says it was first fishing in the South China Seas as a nation state. So it says it has a long historical claim, a long historical right to sovereignty in these areas. You know, Vietnam and China have lost people. They shed blood over this in the 70s and 80s. I don't think there's any sign that anyone wants to repeat that at the moment. But, you know, much of this presence in the South China Sea is centered around a military presence. It is of huge strategic significance for China, make no mistake about that. But it seems very unlikely that, as I said, all that construction is suddenly going to stop because of a ruling from an arbitration panel, which China has utterly dismissed in terms of its validity.
And Robin Brandt, if this ruling is basically ignored by the Chinese, I wonder what happens next. They're going to feel, I assume, in Beijing that they can do even more.
There are signs, perhaps, in one of the statements released from the government this evening that, you know, they want to see negotiations. It's fairly conciliatory. They talk about win-win situations and joint development of some of the islands. But that, of course, relies on China retaining a sense of sovereignty, a sense of legality in being there, a right to be there. That is something that has been completely rejected by this panel.
That's the BBC's Robin Brandt joining us from Beijing. Robin, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we start with a warning to dog owners. Now, your pet may already be under the bed with the rain sound, but we're about to play another sound that in some homes or cars could wreak havoc. Thunder. It's frightening to two-legged creatures, especially children, but dogs can have extreme fear of thunder and other noises. There are 70 million dog owners in the U.S., and a third of them report problems with noise. And now there's a new drug, Cilio, which comes in gel form in a syringe. It can be injected into the dog's mouth. It starts working in 30 to 60 minutes, wears off after 2 to 3 hours, and veterinarians are raving about it. Dr. Peter Eag is one of many vets testing Cilio on some of his clients, reporting the results to the developer, Zoetis. He's based in Poolesville, Maryland, and joins us now. And Dr. Eag, we want to know more about Cilio, but first, what happens to dogs? Why is it that thunderstorms, you know, car backfires, fireworks can send so many of them into such a panic?
Well, it's a great question. And the broader aspect is what's called noise aversion. And that has to do with the fact that various scary noises that can frighten small children and even adults can do the same to animals. And one of the situations is a very simple rudimentary reflex, and that's called the fight or flight syndrome. And what happens is your noradrenaline levels build up. And when they reach a certain threshold, it says to your brain, look, you either have to take care of this situation or get away from this situation. And that's what creates the panic-like situation that occurs with some people in thunderstorm situations or other noise-associated situations, or in dogs especially.
The New York Times Science section took a look at this. Jackhammers, lawnmowers, coffee grinders, all of these things can do it.
Sure.
But thunderstorms, there's something about it. Some dogs, I had the late, great Homie. I knew when a thunderstorm was coming because he started trembling.
Oh, thunderstorms are a unique creature. There are pressure changes. There are very low frequency and high frequency sounds. There are very, very intense lights. And then the rain itself, many times it's just the sound of the rain and hail. All of those relay into factors. And so a young dog will have been exposed to this, or the mother of that dog will have already had a fearful event, and she will then confer to the young dog, look, when this happens, you need to be fearful. And then they hear those sounds and they become fearful associated with those sounds. And then sometimes what happens is dogs will generalize. They'll hear the thunder and then they'll hear a car backfire and they'll say, well, now the car backfiring makes me just as scared as the thunder itself.
Right.
And they'll start to branch out in what they were afraid of. So it can be a gateway to a lot of fears for dogs.
And we're not talking about, you know, people who want their dogs just to be a little happier. We're talking about dogs who will take off like a shot, run through glass, tear their nails out, tearing at a door to get out. I mean, it just can be horrible behavior. So talk about this new drug. I was told by my vet, and don't do anything that you're hearing us talk about here until you've talked to your vet, but, you know, maybe a little tiny piece of Benadryl, depending on what weight the dog was, might calm them down. You know, others tried the security wraps. And there are some drugs out there. What's the difference with Cilio?
Well, over 30 years in practice, we have tried many, many things for dogs who have fear of noises, especially thunderstorms. We have recommended a variety of different compounds, both naturally occurring compounds and chemical compounds. And they've had varying effects, but there's been nothing that has really helped stop the fear and the trepidation that occurs with thunderstorms especially and other types of noise aversion in dogs. My own dog, Ernie, who has since passed on, he was a perfect example. When the thunder would strike, you could just see that all reason went out of his little brain, and he would just run in a straight line for hours, if possible, trying to get away from it. And my own little dog now, Annabelle, who was one of the first dogs that got to experience this new compound, Cilio, she was the same way. She would try to crawl under me, on top of my head, get away from anything she could. This medication, one of the beautiful things about this medication is that it relaxes them and it calms them without sedating them. It allows them to continue on in their normal fashion so they can still hear you. They can still get up and walk with you. They can do other things. It just alleviates that terrible fear and terrible stress that occurs when they break over that threshold and start to become panicked by those thunderstorms. So it's one of those compounds it's a once-in-a-generation compound, I think, where I have fought for 30 years trying to help my canine friends with these different types of fears associated with noise, and this compound really works. I have had it now for about 2 months, and it has just been actually released to the general veterinary community. And I will tell you that I have about 25, 30 clients now who have been using it. Every one of them has reported good to excellent results. And I've gotten pictures from clients. I've gotten phone calls from clients. They have brought me treats, you know, candy and things, thanking me for having a medication that actually finally works.
Well, so we should say you're not being paid by Zoetis to try Cilio on your patients. But what is it? And are there possible side effects or misuse of it?
Sure. It's a great question. And that's one of the most important things for your listeners to know is that this is a prescribed medication. You have to get it from your veterinarian. You have to bring your animal to your veterinarian, that you have a conversation with them, an examination, making sure that your pet is healthy. This drug is in a class of drugs that blocks noradrenaline release. And so one of the other effects of this drug in higher concentrations is actually as a pre-anesthetic sedative. And I've used this drug for many years in the surgical situation, sedating dogs and getting them comfortable before surgery and using it as a pain medication during surgery. In its micro dosing, which is what they've formulated it in a gel form, it goes in between the gum and the cheek, and it's released in that fashion. And in that fashion, its effect is much more minimal, and it affects the release of noradrenaline. And by stopping that, it stops that panic situation that these dogs find themselves in. One of the things to know about these compounds is they all have effects on the central nervous system. And so that's why it's important to talk with your veterinarian before you administer it. Don't just get it from your neighbor and try it without doing it, because if your dog has significant heart disease or kidney disease or liver disease, you'll want to know about that, because this drug may not be right for your pet.
No. And again, we want to underscore that distinction that you made. And in the past, I mean, Benadryl is one thing. And again, don't do anything before talking to your vet, because what you can give a dog has to do with their weight and, as you said, the possible heart problems. But prior to this, there were sedatives, tranquilizers, things that just made them bleh.
Oh, absolutely. And they have their own side effect issues. I mean, acepromazine is a very common compound that has been prescribed by veterinarians over the years for this type of fear effect. But it is a potent relaxing agent, a tranquilizer. And one of the real realities of this is we've found that it has no effect on taking the fear away. It just makes them so sleepy and sloppy that they can't run away from the fear. Whereas what we found with Cilio is it actually takes the fear away. So like my little dog, Annabelle, she just sits next to me very comfortably. The storm is raging. And she looks around like, oh, there's the lightning, there's the thunder. Hey, I think I'll have a cookie now. You know, so it's wonderful to see the difference.
Well, a syringe, I understand, costs about $30. There's a few doses in it. It does have side effects in a few dogs of vomiting. So know that.
Yep.
I'm sure that, you know, like any medication, you want to keep it out of the reach of children, things like that. But if somebody doesn't yet want to go to a medication, and maybe they don't have dogs that have such severe reaction, what else can you do? Because the advice is mixed. Some say, oh, hold your dog. And then lately we're hearing, don't hold your dog. He feels trapped. What else can you do during a thunderstorm with a dog?
I can tell you the most important thing to do is not to cuddle them and coddle them and give them that, oh, it's okay, it's okay. Because what you're doing is you're informing them that I am stressed, and because I'm stressed when this is going on, that it's okay for you to be more stressed. You want to go through your normal activity like nothing is going on. Hey, would you like a treat? Hey, why don't we go over and sit down over here? That's the most important thing you can do. Now, if you have a dog who's developing these fears and these phobias, there are some natural compounds that you can use. issues, composure, which is made up of naturally occurring compounds, one of which is milk colostrum, calf colostrum, and they have naturally calming effects. The same compounds that are in turkey that after you've had your turkey dinner make you nice and relaxed and want to fall asleep in front of the football game, they have those compounds in them also. And as you said, Benadryl has some sedating effect, but much more minimal than people would think. And there are some other compounds available also. I think that anytime you start to see your dog develop that situation, talk with your veterinarian first. They will give you initial steps to take. One of the things you talked about were thunder shirts.
Yeah, thunder shirts, but they wrap them around dogs.
They wrap them around, and what they do is they remind the dog when he was a puppy and he was able to cuddle underneath his mom's arm and feel safe. And the other thing you can do for your dogs is find a room in the house that doesn't have an outdoor window and has a door that you can and can be dark, and you can place them in that room while the storm is going on, so that they, number one, can't see the lightning. It's harder to hear the thunder, and they don't perceive any other problems going on.
Yeah.
So there's some other easy steps. But now that we have Cilio, I will tell you, it is as safe as this compound is, the minimal side effect issues, it is really going to change the lives of a lot of people who have their dogs, you know, knocking over the kitchen table and breaking the door and going through the screen.
And hurting themselves. Yeah, hurting themselves.
And definitely hurting themselves, yes. I mean, my own dog, Ernie, he hurt himself very badly one time just racing away from a storm. We were out cleaning the stalls in our barn, and that out of nowhere, a clap of lightning went down. The thunder roared, and man, he went right through the door to the back of the barn, and he cut himself pretty significantly.
Yeah. Dr. Peter Eeg, veterinarian in Poolesville, Maryland, on some new thinking, new drug, and then old thinking, too, that still might work about dogs and noise. Doctor, thank you.
Thank you very much, Robin. I appreciate your time.
And while we're on the topic of frightening weather, parts of Minnesota and Wisconsin are recovering from flooding rain and tornadoes. Litchfield, Minnesota's mayor says in 52 years he's never seen a storm like it. The National Weather Service estimated at least 4 tornadoes occurred in central Minnesota yesterday. There's also major flooding further north in northern Minnesota and northwest Wisconsin. Flooding led to the closing of a stretch of Interstate 35. It's since reopened. And meteorologists say next week a high-pressure system in the middle of the country could produce summer high temperatures in Chicago, Des Moines, Iowa, Omaha, Nebraska. They say some temperatures could top the century mark. And, you know, those high temperatures might mean thunder boomers. Markets in the U.S. have been having a good day after a very good day yesterday when the S&P 500 closed at a record high 2,137 points and the Dow also closed at a high for the year. Wait, what about that plunge after the Brexit vote? Did it just take Britain to announce a new prime minister for markets to recover? Jason Bellini of the Wall Street Journal joins us from New York. Hi, Jason.
Hi there, Robin.
And we can never know exactly what's going on with markets, but we did get the news yesterday that Theresa May will become the next prime minister of the UK after David Cameron's departure tomorrow. There's been pictures of moving vans at Downing Street. How much did that add to the joy in the markets?
The moving van effect. Well, one thing we know about investors is that they hate uncertainty. And now there appears to be more certainty coming to the political situation. I mean, you've got investors in Europe who are now buying up stocks again following the Brexit vote. They also got news that British banks that were absolutely hammered following the Brexit vote, they're gaining on this political certainty as well. And also European auto shares were up nearly 4%. Daimler was up 5%, Peugeot about 6%. Those companies reporting a rise in European demand for cars.
So a new prime minister is coming to Britain, continuity there, but it's not over yet, is it?
Not over by a long shot, and it's going to be many months of decisions, big and small, that are going to have an impact on the markets. But here in the U.S., you got many investors that are predicting that the markets are going to remain choppy. I mean, financial markets, particularly in Europe, have been highly volatile for quite some time now. And this comes on top of, let's not forget, a year in which you've had investors spooked by sinking commodity prices, slowing Chinese growth, and Europe's fragile banking system. None of those issues have been fully resolved, and so there could be more headlines that move markets.
Well, of course, and as we know, Britain still has to negotiate all its new relationships with all the individuals of countries in the EU instead of the broad EU treaties and trade deals that it had. So the markets might still react some more. But we also have Japan's stock average closing at 2.5% higher today. There was a 4% gain on Monday. after a victory for the ruling party of Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. So again, certainty?
A little more certainty, but also that's coupled with some hopeful speculation on the part of investors. Speculation that there's this meeting that happened Tuesday between U.S. Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke and Mr. Abe, and they're hoping that this radical measure known as helicopter money, that's when a central bank directly funds government spending. They're hoping that that's going to be the policy that will have a depreciating impact on the yen, better for the economy. And that's why investors are saying, yeah, all right, let's buy into the Nikkei index right now. It added 4%. That was its biggest one-day gain since March. And then there's also the Pokemon effect. Mm-hmm. Do you know what that is?
Sure, Pokemon Go. Does anyone not know? Well, perhaps some people do. So this is this new game that's got everybody out in the streets looking for Pokemon characters.
Global Mania, Nintendo, Japanese company, it added 13% on Tuesday. Mm. And that's a big sign of hope that its mobile game business is going to add to profits.
Jason Bellini of The Wall Street Journal. Jason, thanks as always.
Thank you.
We've been talking about the shooting in Dallas last week as a tragedy for the city, a difficult moment for the country. But for the people who were shot and for their families, it's life-changing. Sergeant Mike Smith of the Dallas Police Department was killed last week. His 9-year-old daughter, Caroline, spoke with CBS News.
He was leaving to go to work, and I was leaving to go to a movie, and he said to me, "What if this is the last time you ever kissed me or hugged me?"
Did he always say that?
No. That was probably the first time he ever said that.
Was his kiss any different?
Yes, it was.
How?
It just felt different to me. I thought something bad was going to happen.
It was heartbreaking to listen to. And as we mourn those killed in Dallas today, people in Orlando are also marking 1 month since the deadliest mass shooting in U.S. history, when 49 people were killed in the Pulse nightclub and 53 others were injured. One of those injured was 37-year-old Jeff Rodriguez, who was shot 3 times and remains at the Orlando Regional Medical Center. When the shooting started inside Pulse, Rodriguez hid in a bathroom stall with 14 other people. He texted his younger brother Santos from the stall, "Been shot at club, dying, I love you." Santos thought he was joking. It wasn't until he started seeing late-night headlines that he realized the truth. Rodriguez's family waited until 7 o'clock the next evening before they learned that Jeff had survived. We'll post the text chain at hereandnow.org. Santos Rodriguez III joins us from Orlando. Thank you so much for joining us, and what an exchange that you had with your brother on text that night.
Yes, to be honest with you, I still can't believe I didn't believe him. Mm. But yeah, it's thinking about it, I feel bad, and we laugh about it now.
You laugh about it now.
Oh yeah, even when I first saw him the first day, I was like, "Hey, I believe your text." By the way, he starts like he moves his head like, "You idiot!" Like,
well, how is he doing now?
He's how do I say it? Like, it's going to be a long recovery road for my brother here. He's doing a lot better from day one, of course. He's had, like, I think, 5 or 6 surgeries, and they've all been very, life or death type situations. And then he's learning how to walk now. So it's kind of hard for him to, he can't stand up for too long, so he starts getting dizzy, you throw up. So it's therapy 3 times a day. That's pretty much where he's at now. I know he had skin graft surgery 3 days ago. He has a big, big hole in his right leg. So that's, they had to cover that up.
And he's able to talk to you, though?
Oh, yeah, he's able to talk. He's able to joke around a little bit. He's able to eat normal foods. But he still gets dizzy, and he throws up every so often.
And what's the prognosis at this point? Will he be able to eventually walk like normal?
When you go to the hospital, you never come back normal. That's for everyone. Right now, he has problems with his right leg. He can move it and so forth, but they're trying to teach him, how to use that leg again, how it was before. So they said that he should be able to walk. He should be able to do his things. He loves to dance. So, you know, we're hoping and praying that he goes back to the best that he can to what he was before. So the nurses and doctors did state that he will go back to normal, but it will be a long road.
And how's he doing in handling all of that?
Man, to be honest, he's a lot stronger than I am. And I still would have been screaming over there, like, "Oh my god, my leg!" But you know, he's still in shock with the whole situation. You know, he has his moments. Everyone has their moments, you know. So besides that, he's doing pretty good mentally. He's there, but you know, it's like I said, a long road for recovery for you know, inside him and so forth, like mental and for everything.
What about you and the rest of your family? How are you guys doing with all this?
We're doing good. Yeah, we live about 2 hours away, so we have to drive 2 hours here and there. I know for the first 3 weeks, I stayed in Orlando, making sure everything was okay and visiting him, massaging him, so forth, and helping whatever he needs and getting things organized. So we're taking it, you know, day by day, but so far, knowing that he's a lot better, that he's alive, that took off a big load of weight there.
Now, you've set up a GoFundMe page to raise money for your brother's recovery, and we'll link to that at hereandnow.org. Mm-hmm. You're almost at your goal of $25,000.
Yes.
How are things going financially, and what are the kind of expenses that you're incurring?
Expenses, you know, medical bills, so far they're saying that, you know, there might be some medical bills, and so we're trying to figure out how that's going to be paid and if we're going to get help with that or whatnot.
Have you gotten to know any of the other survivors and their families through all of this?
Actually, yeah. I'm actually good friends with Angel Santiago. He's a good friend of ours, good friend of my brother's. I met him through my brother, and he's handling it. You know, he has his, you know, he's a strong guy as well. But it's him and V that I know of.
And what do you talk about with them now?
Now we just regular talks, regular conversation. I mean, and we do, you know, talk about the, you know, club posts, and it does bring tears in some eyes. And so we talk about it, but we try not to talk about it. But it's kind of hard not to talk about it. The whole family is thankful for V and Angel for everything. You know, they helped out my brother a lot in the bathroom. So if it wasn't for V, I know he would have not been alive right now.
As you have seen, people from all around the country and all around the world have tried to help in some way after the attack in Orlando. What does that mean to you, or how does it feel when you're in the middle of it and you've got all these people that you don't know trying to help out?
You know, I think it's pretty cool how this, not just the country, but the whole world just got together and just started helping whatever way they can do, like however way they can do it, they just started help. And I thought that was pretty cool how that worked out. Too bad it has to be through a tragic situation. I wish it was like that all year round, like helping each other out, being kind to one another. you know, it's pretty cool because I get a lot of emails. It's like random people, like from UK, from, you know, California, Australia. It's just a bunch of random people that's messaging me to see how my brother is. And I, you know, I update them with everything I can. I know it's kind of hard. So if they're listening, I'm sorry if I have a few emails or whatever I have not replied to. It's kind of hard. I have like 50 emails, like on a daily basis.
I'm sure they understand.
Yeah.
So how do you, and how does your brother make sense of what happened at this point?
It's kind of, I don't know, it's kind of hard to make sense on it. It just sucks, to be honest with you. I don't know, I guess we're all still in shock about it. It's weird at the same time. It's sad. It's we're all still like foggy a little bit about the situation.
Have you changed anything that you do in your daily life as a result of it? Are you worried that something like this is going to happen again?
you know, it's going to happen again. I know that for a fact. You know, it's getting worse every day. My daily stuff has not changed. I know that. I know when I hear sirens, I get flashbacks of that night when we were in Orlando. So when I hear it, I just think of me and my father running down the street and right where Club Pulse was. But that's the only thing that's changed.
That's Santos Rodriguez III, whose big brother Jeff Rodriguez was injured in the Pulse nightclub shooting last month. He is still in the hospital in Orlando. Santos, thanks so much for joining us, and we wish your brother all the best in his recovery.
Thank you, guys.
Pokemon Go may be taking over the world. At least it may seem that way, as the smartphone game is surging in popularity. It's based on the Japanese franchise from the 90s, and it uses augmented reality and GPS to send players out into the real world. Now, it's the top downloaded free app in the App Store, and the latest numbers say the game may be outpacing Twitter in daily active users on Android. So, how does a smartphone game go viral overnight? Let's turn to our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. A special Pokemon Recode bump this week. Kurt Wagner is senior editor of social media at Recode. He's with us from San Francisco. Hi, Kurt.
Hi. I thought that music sounded familiar.
You're right. It's a little different. But remind us, and for people who haven't played the game, and I'm going to put myself in that category, I have not played Pokemon Go yet, but how does it work briefly?
Sure. So essentially, you kind of touched on it in the intro there. The idea is that the app lets you catch Pokemon out in the real world. So it uses Google Maps. You create a character that lives on this map. And as you walk around your neighborhood or your city or whatever it may be, you come across, you know, fictitious Pokemon out in the wild. And when you find them, you can hold your phone up and augmented reality, it will project essentially a Pokemon so that it looks like it's standing right there on the sidewalk in front of you. You can try to capture it, train it, trade it with other people. So it's essentially taking the gameplay and attempting to get you off the couch and playing in the actual real world.
And such a huge success. How long did it take to put this together? And is the technology behind this very different from other games?
So this company that made this game, it's called Niantic, and it was actually incubated inside of Google. And so the folks who made this game were involved with, you know, helping to make Google's location projects like Google Maps, for example, or Google Earth. And, you know, a few years ago, they started making games as well. And this idea for a Pokemon game came about. And when Google became Alphabet about a year ago in the fall, Niantic spun out and became its own gaming company. So this game has been in the works for some time, but the technology, the maps technology, the augmented reality stuff, I mean, that's been in the works for a while. And while it's not necessarily brand new, for example, if you use Google Maps, you probably use a lot of the same stuff on your phone. It's just packaged in a totally different way. And I think that that's what's making it so interesting to people who are, you know, just trying this out for the first time.
And is this going to be the new wave of video games that they actually do take you outside into the real world? You don't just sit there and play them at home.
Well, I think parents would like that a lot, right? I mean, get your kids out of the house and in the backyard. I think the idea of having a smart computer in your pocket at all times, right? Like the mobile phone is so powerful now. And you can really do a lot of stuff that you didn't used to be able to do on a phone. And so, you know, it required for you to sit in front of the TV and have this big, massive Xbox or PlayStation or whatever it was, this big computer sitting in front of you. But now you can do so much of that on your phone that I think the idea of bringing your games wherever you go, so the idea of mobile gaming is, I mean, it's not new by any stretch, but I think when you kind of put a spin on it like Pokemon has been able to do here, that's certainly going to catch people's attention.
You know, the other thing that's not new by any stretch is Pokemon. And it's just kind of surprising that it came out in the 90s and then it kind of went away. And now all of a sudden it's come back. And it was a niche thing that certain people were into. But now it's gone mainstream just overnight.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was a pretty big deal. I can speak from personal experience. I remember playing the game growing up myself a little bit. And so when I saw Pokemon Go come out, it was this blast from the past, right? I mean, it was this nostalgia, this wave of nostalgia comes over you. And
yeah.
I think that's one of the reasons so many people are jumping at the Pokemon Go game is that they're remembering when they were younger and playing with all of these same characters. And so... Yes, Pokemon, I believe, is 20 years old now. So it's the fact that in the last week we're all of a sudden talking about it again is a little surprising. But at the same time, you know how things go in waves, and especially clothing styles and movies and things like that. They come and go, and I think this is just the next iteration of that.
And get ready then, I guess, for the Tamagotchi game or the Tickle Me Elmo
exactly.
game is going to be the next thing that comes out. Now, I just have to ask you about privacy concerns because Nintendo,
sure.
which published this, has gotten some criticism for that.
Yeah, so because it was incubated inside of Google initially, or at least this company was, it uses Google login for people to create a character in the game. And so in order to sign up, you have to hand over your username and password, which is essentially the thing that also gets you into your email or gets you into your photos that you store with Google. And so Niantic took a lot of heat over the last couple days because people realized that they were requesting permission to access all of that stuff.
Mm.
They came out with a statement yesterday and said, hey, that was we didn't actually need all of that information. We're not actually looking at all of that information. We're working to kind of reduce what we have access to.
Hmm.
But that was people don't want to pass along all of that information just to play Pokemon.
That's Kurt Wagner, a senior editor of social media for Recode, speaking with us about what else Pokemon Go taking over the world. Kurt, thanks so much as always.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.